forced to marry the crippled Alpha King. On their wedding night, he stood up and spoke her. Grandmother had a saying she kept sewn into everything she made. The still water cuts the deepest channel. Marin Ashvale had never fully understood it as a child. She'd imagined rivers, patient, invisible work beneath stone, but she hadn't felt it in her body yet, hadn't needed to. Then her parents died in the border collapse when she was 14, and her wolf never came at the calling at 16, and the saying stopped being poetry and became something she wore like a second skin. Still, patient, cutting slow and deep where no one thought to look. She was 22, the winter they gave her away to the Broken King. She tucked her grandmother's last letter into the bodice of her dress before she left the Ashvale cottage for the final time. A folded square of paper worn soft as cloth from rereading. She did not cry. Still, water does not cry. It moves. Chapter 1. The Arrangement. The village of Crest Hollow sat at the edge of Velmore territory, like a thumbprint someone had tried to smudge away. Its people were pack-adjacent. They owed tribute to the great Velmore Alpha bloodline and received protection in return, though in Marin's experience, the protection mostly took the form of soldiers who ate their stores in autumn. Wolfless, Marin had no formal standing in the pack hierarchy. She worked the healer's cottage, foraged the ridge, and paid her tithe in dried medicines no one gave her credit for preparing. It was the headman, Draven Colby, who came to her door on the first frost of the season. He did not knock so much as fill the doorframe, a broad man with a broker's smile and a bureaucrat's eyes. He brought two witnesses, which meant he meant to make something official. The Velmore King's stewards have put out a request. He said it the way people announce good news they are giving themselves, not you. His Majesty Calder Velmore requires a bride. Given his current condition, the court has lowered certain expectations. Wolfless applicants are now considered acceptable. Marin set down the mortar she'd been working. A bride for the king. She kept her voice level, which seemed to unsettle him. He'd expected tears or gratitude. His Majesty suffered injuries in the Eastern Campaign. He is... Colby paused for the shape of the words. He does not walk. The court requires a caretaker who can also fulfill the role of queen. The arrangement suits your situation. Your situation. Wolfless, parentless, tithable. Worth just enough to give away to someone equally discarded. And if I decline? Colby's smile didn't change, but his witnesses shifted. Your tithe exemption would need review. The cottage lease, too. So, it was not a question. She had known that before she asked, had asked only to make him say it plainly, to take the comfortable mask off the thing. Marin looked around the cottage, her grandmother's dried bundles on the rafters, the worn smooth table, the window that caught the morning light at an angle she had arranged her whole small life to appreciate. I'll need until morning to pack. Chapter 2. The Broken King. The Velmore seat was called Ashenmere, and it deserved the name, a great gray palace built against a cliff face, its towers half shrouded in morning mist, even at midday, its halls wide enough to feel empty, regardless of how many people filled them. Marin arrived by cart, was received by a steward who looked at her homespun coat with the practiced neutrality of someone swallowing something unpleasant, and was installed in a set of rooms she was told adjoined the king's chambers. She was given 3 days before the ceremony. She spent them learning the palace's rhythms the way she learned every new terrain, quietly, observantly, without announcing herself. On the second day, she found the king. Not because she was brought to him, no one offered, but because she followed the sound of something breaking. A clay cup, as it turned out, hurled at the far wall of the solar with impressive precision. She stepped through the open door without announcement, and the man in the wheeled chair turned sharply, expecting a servant to flinch. She didn't flinch. Calder Velmore was not what the word crippled had assembled in her mind. She'd pictured something diminished, and what she saw instead was barely contained. He was perhaps 30, dark-haired, with the broad frame of a man built for force, and the expression of someone who had been furious for a very long time, and was now simply tired of how heavy that was. His legs, beneath a wool blanket, were motionless. His hands on the chair's arms were not. The wolfless girl. His voice was low and declarative, shaped for commands even now. The broken king. She said it back with equal flatness. Not cruelty, just honesty, meeting honesty. He stared at her. Around them, the broken cup leaked water into the stone floor. She crossed the room, found a cloth by the washstand without asking, and crouched to begin mopping up the water. You don't have to. I know. She kept working. Still water cuts the deepest channel. A silence. Then, what does that mean? I'm still working that out myself. When she stood and looked at him again, something in his face had shifted by a degree too small to name. Not warmth, yet. Just the first crack in a wall that had been sealed for years. Chapter 3. Before the vows. The wedding was scheduled for the fourth evening, a court ceremony, the steward explained, modest in scale given the king's inability to stand for the traditional processional. Inability. Another word she filed carefully away. Marin spent her last morning before the ceremony in the palace's physic garden, taking inventory of what grew there. It was badly tended. Someone had been negligent for months, perhaps longer, pulling attention from the healing plants to the ornamental ones. She began pulling dead growth and noting what could be revived. The court watched her when they thought she wasn't watching them. She heard the layered vocabulary of contempt that followed her down corridors. Wolfless, charity bride, the village girl, whoever she is. She cataloged it alongside the dead garden plants. Things that needed clearing away. On her third afternoon, she was summoned to the king's solar, properly this time by a steward, and found Calder Velmore with scrolls across his wheeled tray, a correspondence battle apparently ongoing with half his council. Sit, he said, and then seemed to realize how that sounded, and amended. Please. She sat across from him and waited, which she suspected was not what he expected. The council tells me you were conscripted into this. He wasn't looking at her, addressing the scrolls instead. That Colby in Crest Hollow effectively coerced your agreement. He leveraged my situation, yes. I didn't know that when the request went out. The stewards were... A muscle worked in his jaw. I was given to understand the candidates were willing. Does it change anything? You're needing a wife who will also manage your care? He looked up. His eyes were the dark amber of old wood, and they were used to reading people at distance. It might change how I treat you. Whether you want... He stopped. The fluency went out of him in a way that she recognized. It was the stutter of someone who has stopped expecting to matter to anyone. What I want, Marin said carefully, is to be dealt with, honestly. Everything else is negotiable. He held her gaze for a beat longer than was strictly polite, and then nodded. Once, the way people do when they're filing something important away. Chapter 4. The Wedding. They were married in the Ashenmere Great Hall at the hour when the cliff mist came down thickest, so that the tall windows were gray and impenetrable, and the candle-lit hall felt like its own universe sealed apart from everything outside. Marin wore her best dress, not palace standard, but clean and well-fitted, with her grandmother's letter pressed against her heartbeat beneath the fabric. The court watched with the uniform expression of people attending an event they considered beneath them. Calder was brought in by the side entrance in his wheeled chair, his steward positioned beside him. He wore formal Velmore gray, and he held himself in the chair with the rigidity of someone refusing to be seen as less than he was. Marin walked the length of the aisle alone, without escort, chin level, and she felt the court's collective assessment settle on her like weather. The officiator spoke the old words, the binding oaths, the recognition of bond, the scent-sealing clause that the wolfless could participate in only in adapted form. When it came to the physical seal of the vow, the tradition was for the alpha to rise and place a coronet on his bride's head. A murmur went around the hall. She heard someone near the back whisper, "He can't," and the word ceremony and the word farce in the same breath. Marin looked at Calder. His jaw was clamped shut. His hands were white-knuckled on the chair arms. And she watched something move through him, not giving up and not explosion either, but decision. The very specific look of a person deciding. The steward moved to take the coronet from the altar cushion. Calder said, quietly but carrying, "Leave it." Every sound in the hall stopped. He put his hands on the chair arms, and he pushed, not frantically, not with the panicked energy of attempting something impossible, but with the deliberate force of a man who had been doing something in secret for a very long time, and was now choosing to make it visible. The legs that everyone had written off trembled. The blanket fell. He stood. Not easily. The standing cost him. She could see it in every line of his body. The enormous, concentrated expenditure of it. But he stood at his full height, which was considerable, and the hall was absolutely silent around that fact. He took the 3 steps to where she stood. He lifted the coronet with hands that shook only slightly, and placed it on her dark hair, and his amber eyes were fixed on hers, with an intensity that felt like the first honest thing that had happened in this hall in years. Then, still standing, still holding her gaze, "I see you, Marin Ashvile. Not your use, not your compliance. You. A beat. I have been practicing the standing for 4 months. I did not know until this moment who I was standing for." The silence held for 2 more seconds. Then it broke into noise. Chapter 5. The Wedding Night. The court's noise was complicated, not all approval, not by any means. Marin heard the scrambling recalibration as she walked beside Calder's chair back down the aisle, his hand now resting on the chair arm rather than her arm, because walking was not yet a sustained thing for him, only that remarkable, costly declaration. The whispers were a different tenor now. "He hid it from us." "Why? What does this mean for succession? For the council?" She didn't listen to them. She was watching his hands. In the private corridor beyond the great hall, away from the candles and the court, Calder let out a breath that seemed to come from somewhere fundamental. His steward, a lean older man named Orvin, who had said approximately 4 words to Marin since her arrival, looked at him with an expression that was neither approval nor disapproval, but something quieter. The look of someone who has been keeping a secret so long that its release is almost physical. Marin turned to Orvin. "Was it you who helped him? The physic work?" Orvin inclined his head. "And himself. Mostly himself. From the hour the physician said never, which was when he started." Calder made a sound that wasn't quite dismissive and wasn't quite modest. "Orvin is generous. He means stubborn." She looked at the king. She could not yet think of him by name without the shape of it feeling too large. And saw the exhaustion that the standing had cost him, and also the way he was watching her receive this information. Testing for her reaction. Waiting for the thing that would confirm she was just like all the others. She did not perform wonder at him. She didn't exclaim or dissolve into admiration. She said, "4 months." Quietly. While everyone called it impossible. She held his gaze. "Still water cuts the deepest channel." The flicker that crossed his face was brief and deep as a struck match. "You said that in the solar, the morning we met. My grandmother's saying." "Say it again," he said. Not a command, a request. The difference in it subtle, but real. "What does it mean? You said you were still working it out." They were at the door of his chambers. She pushed it open and held it, and he wheeled through, and she followed, and Orvin, with the discretion of long practice, did not. The room was firelit, large, lined with books, more than she'd expected, more personal and less ceremonial than the rest of the palace. A room a person actually lived in. "I think it means," she said, settling into the chair nearest the fire while he positioned across from her, "that the things which look passive, the still parts of a person, the quiet bearing, the endurance that no one witnesses, those are the things doing the real work, making the real shape." A pause. "The way you worked, alone, for 4 months, on something everyone had told you was finished. No one watching. Just the effort and the intention." He was quiet for a long time, looking at the fire. "I thought I was hiding weakness. Another pause. I think perhaps I was protecting something. A possibility. In case it came to something. The fire moved between them. Neither of them moved toward the other that night. The evening was too full of things already said, and things only beginning to be understood. But when Marin finally rose to go to her own adjoining chamber, he said her name for the first time. Marin. She turned. Thank you for not flinching. In the solar, and everywhere since. His voice had the careful weight of someone placing something fragile down precisely. I'm not sure I deserved that. You didn't need to deserve it, she said. It wasn't for you. I don't flinch for anyone else's sake. I do it for my own. She went to bed with her grandmother's letter on the nightstand and lay listening to the fire through the door and thought about channels being cut, invisible, through stone. Chapter 6. The Palace Shifts. The weeks that followed the wedding were a kind of siege, but she had been sieged before and knew the tactics. The court came at her in layers, first with the performative courtesies that meant nothing, then with exclusions so small they were designed to be impossible to name aloud, then finally with direct challenges dressed as questions. Lady Sephra Vole, who led what Marin came to think of as the architecture of the court's disdain, appeared at the Physic Garden 3 weeks after the wedding, with three companions arranged just slightly behind her, the precise formation of someone expecting to deliver and not to discuss. The Queen's role traditionally involves hosting the Council's formal suppers, Sephra said, her voice the temperature of the mist outside. I imagine the protocols will be challenging for someone from Crest Hollow. Marin had her hands in the garden bed, working a root out of the clay. She did not stand up. I imagine they will. She extracted the root and examined it. The Physic Garden's been neglected for 2 seasons. Most of what the Velmore healers need is either imported or going without because the growing was abandoned. I'll fix that by spring. The suppers. She stood now, brushing clay from her hands and meeting Sephra's eyes. I'll learn what I need to learn. I tend to. Sephra's eyes moved over her. The homespun, the earth on her hands. The coronet she was not wearing, because she wore it to formal occasions, and not to gardens. The king has not eaten supper with the court in 8 months. No, Marin agreed. But he ate supper with me last Tuesday, and Thursday. We're working our way through the week. She smiled, not combatively, and went back to her knees in the garden bed. Behind her, she heard the geometry of Sephra's formation consult itself without words, and then retreat. The suppers were true. She had begun them without calculation, simply appearing at Calder's door on her second week with 2 plates from the kitchen and a direct look that said, "This is happening more clearly than words." He had accepted with the frozen bewilderment of a man who had been alone with his meals for long enough that company felt theoretical. By the 3rd week, they were talking through supper regularly about the council's correspondence, which she began to read alongside him. About the pack territories and the border politics that had cost him his legs and cost the eastern settlements their safety. About her grandmother. About the healer's practice in Crest Hollow. About all the small, complicated geography of being underestimated for a lifetime. He told her, one evening, how the injury had happened. A campaign gone wrong. A bridge collapse. An alpha who could feel his pack through the mate bond and through the territory sense, but could no longer stand at the head of his army. How the council had begun treating him as provisional. How he'd felt the chair as a sentence. And then the possibility, she prompted. He turned his cup in his hands. And then I started, in the dark, working at it. The way you work at something you can't tell anyone about, because hope is more vulnerable than pain. Yes, she said, and meant it in her bones. She reached across the table and put her hand over his. It was the first time she had touched him with intention, and he looked at her hand as though it were a phenomenon, something he needed to document carefully so that he'd know it had actually happened. Chapter 7. The Second Standing. The council meeting on the 42nd day of their marriage was the formal one, the one Marin understood, from corridor conversation and the tone of Calder's correspondence, would establish whether the king would continue to be managed around, or would begin managing again. She did not attend it. It wasn't her place yet, She knew enough to know that some battles must be witnessed rather than fought alongside. She spent the morning in the physic garden, and the afternoon teaching the head healer what she'd known about the sorrel root compounds since she was 15, information that had been locked in a wolfless girl in Crest Hollow for 7 years, and was now moving into the Velmore medical record. The council meeting was scheduled for 2 hours. It ran for 4. When it was over, Orvin found her in the corridor and told her, in his quiet way, that the king had asked for her. The council chamber was empty by the time she reached it, just Calder at the head of the long table, his chair and the surface covered in the aftermath of something conclusive. He looked like a man who had just finished a different kind of standing. "They pushed for regency," he said without preamble. "Lord Haver and 3 others, on the grounds of..." He stopped, and she saw him decide not to soften it. "On the grounds of my physical diminishment, my inability to lead a campaign or enforce pack law personally." "And?" "And I gave them the medical record. Orvin's documentation of my recovery, which is... a breath. Significant. Ongoing. Not finished, but significant." He looked up at her. "And I told them that the Queen's assessment of the Physic Garden's restoration had identified 3 medicinal deficiencies that were contributing to soldier illness rates along the Western Patrol, which was in Havre's territory, which he had not caught, which she had." Marin was quiet for a moment, then, "You brought me into it." "I brought the truth into it. You happened to be part of the truth." He met her eyes with those amber depths that had stopped testing and started simply seeing. "You've been doing work in this palace that no one credits, because no one was looking. I was looking." Being truly seen, she had not known until that moment how much she had been willing to live without it, how thoroughly she had trained herself not to need it, and how wrong she had been to do that training, because the need had never actually gone away. It had just gone still. She sat down at the table, not across from him, but in the chair beside him. She put her grandmother's letter on the table between them, smoothed and soft and worn. "She never met a wolf either," Marin said. "My grandmother. She was human, entirely, in a pack world. She raised my mother, and she built the healer's cottage, and she knew every living thing on that ridge by name." A pause. "She always said the still water does the real work." Calder looked at the letter, not touching it without invitation. "Can I read it someday?" "Yes," she said. "Someday soon." She did not move her chair back. Chapter 8. The Channel Finds Its Shape. Spring came to Ashenmere with the quality of something that had been waiting politely. The cliff mist thinned, and the physic garden produced its first serious harvest. Sorrel and silverweed, and the 3 varieties of comfrey she'd propagated from clippings, plus the new fennel beds that the head healer had wept slightly about, because fennel for pain management had been imported at great expense for 2 years. Calder walked the garden with her on the morning of the first real spring day, with a cane now, and a slight hitch in his stride that would likely always be there, and which he had stopped performing apology for. Walking was not running. It was not what he'd had before. It was, however, walking, and walking in a garden with his wife, which was a thing he had not expected to have. "The council wants a formal progress," he told her, "a showing-of-strength tour of the territories, the traditional kind, a mounted processional, the alpha visible and present." "Will you?" "We will." He said it without looking at her, in the careful offhand tone of someone saying something enormous, as if it were simply a fact. "If that's agreeable." She stopped beside the fennel bed, looking at him until he turned. "You said we. You're observant. It must be hereditary." But he was almost smiling, which was still a small and careful thing he produced like someone learning a language. "The Western territories especially, where the soldier illness was most acute, where your work made the actual difference. They should see you." She thought of Crest Hollow, of the headman in her doorframe with his broker's smile, of being given to a broken king, as if that were a pairing of 2 damaged things, a zero-sum equation. She thought of 4 months of secret standing in the dark, of still water and stone. "All right," she said. "Then we will." She reached out and took his free hand, the one not on the cane, and held it, which by now was not unprecedented, but still landed on both of them with the precise weight of something that mattered. His grip tightened once, deliberate, like punctuation. Lady Sephrovol, crossing the garden path at the far end with a companion, saw this and said nothing. The nothing was different from the nothings before. The nothing was the beginning of a recalculation. That evening, Calder read her grandmother's letter by firelight, all the way through, without speaking. When he finished, he folded it along its worn creases and handed it back to her with a care that exceeded the paper. "She would have liked you to be seen," he said. "She would have liked to see you stand up in that hall. And yet she wrote that saying about the still water, about invisible work." Marin tucked the letter against her heart. "The point isn't that the work stays invisible. The point is that it happens whether or not anyone is watching. And then eventually," she met his eyes, "eventually the channel is there, and the water runs through it, and everyone can see where it went." He looked at her across the firelight with the specific expression she had come to know as his most honest one, stripped of the command habit and the defensive armoring, just the man underneath who had stood up in a hall full of people who expected him not to. For a woman he was only beginning to know, and somehow already could not imagine the palace without. "I see you," he said. It was the second time. It would not be the last. She let the words settle into her like water into stone. Epilogue. 1 year later. The progress had been a success. The word had spread through Velmore territory the way true things spread. Not in the dramatic burst of announcement, but in the steady accumulation of detail. The queen who knew the names of plants. The king who walked with a cane and did not apologize for it. The pair of them who were, unmistakably, not performing anything. Lord Havre had resigned from the council in winter. Lady Sephra had, against every prediction including her own, become one of the queen's more useful allies. Not from affection, but from pragmatism, and a grudging private respect she would only acknowledge at oblique angles. The physic garden now had two assistant gardeners and a royal charter. The first anniversary of the wedding fell on a day when the cliff mist was low and the hall was warm and there was a private supper, which was how they preferred their evenings, regardless of the court's opinion. Calder had walked the length of the gallery that morning without the cane, for the first time, which he told her about with the same studied understatement he applied to enormous things. She had looked at him for a long moment, and then crossed the room and put her hands on either side of his face and kissed him in the specific way she'd developed for moments that required no words. After supper, she brought out her grandmother's letter, not to read aloud, not for any ceremony, but because she had something to show him. In the lower right corner of the page, beneath her grandmother's closing words, she had written something of her own in the month since her arrival at Ashenmere. Small words, added slowly as they became true. She handed it to him. He read it in the firelight, the letter he knew nearly by memory now, and then the new line at the bottom, in her different hand. "The channel finds its shape. The water runs through." They were both right. It works in the dark, and it works in the light, and eventually there is no difference. He held the letter for a long time. Then he folded it, with the same care he always gave it, and handed it back. She tucked it into the pocket sewn into the inside of her dress, the same place she'd carried it on her wedding day, the place it had lived for a year. "Still water," he said. "Still water," she agreed. He reached across the table and took her hand, and she looked at this man who had stood up when everyone expected him not to, and who saw her, and who understood now, as she understood, that the deepest work is not about stillness or about motion, but about faith in the process. The faith that the channel is being cut even when you cannot see it. That the water will run, eventually. That the patient, unremarkable labor of a person simply being themselves, completely, is the most powerful thing in any world. Outside, the Ashenmere mist rolled in off the cliff face, as it always did at this hour, pressing gray and soft against the tall windows of the hall. Inside, the candles burned. The fire, burned. The letter rested in its pocket against her heartbeat. The still water cuts the deepest channel, and now, at last, she could see exactly.